It's time again for sport's greatest tour, the British and Irish Lions Rugby Tour. Rugby's first ever proper North vs South encounter, and one of the greatest traditions in the game. This time round, the Lions are off to Australia, and the perfect guest to bring us to life is going to be John Robbie. The ex-Irish international toured SA with the Lions back in 1980, at the height of the Lions culture. Is this culture still a thing that is alive and well? Or has professionalism watered this all down into just being another test series? Settle in to hear all about this, and of course what the Aussies will be bringing to the table too. It's episode 53 of the On The Bounce Show. It's the big Lions Tour preview. Let's get into it. All right, welcome to it. The Lions Tour is happening again. Happens every single 4 years. They obviously came to SA the last time around. That was the COVID series. So in many ways, we haven't had a proper Lions Tour in much longer than 4 years. Joining us this week, we have, of course, John Robbie to help us discuss this. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. It's a great honor to be on the program.
Oh, man, my dad's going to love this one. A legend, our ears and in our hearts is on the shelf, Mr. Robbie. Please don't excuse me calling me Mr. Robbie. My dad would kill me if I just called you John.
Sandile, you know what worries me? Soon they're going to be saying, my granddad telling me. No, I'm here. I'm still that young player who played for the Lions.
Yeah.
But in reality, I turned 70 in November.
You make it look a good 45. I'm going to give you that
one. You lie like a cheap carpet, like a cheap carpet.
But John, if granddads are talking about you, then it's the endearing legacy that never ends, though. So there's always the plus.
Oh, thank you so much for trying. Yeah.
I am, I'm so excited about this because the Lions Tour for me is something that should be, I think we should remind people about how great 100%. It is. Because, I mean, like the AI guy said in the voiceover there, sometimes these things get watered down with professionalism. And there is so much sport out there. I mean, right now, this particular week that we are filming, we've got US Open Golf. There's URC Finals Rugby. There's the Ultimate Test, ICC World Test Championship. Football will never, ever go away.
Yes.
So it does. It becomes a blur. Yeah. But the cool thing is we get to sit down with you in the studio right here, and we get to talk about this tour. So how are we going to do this episode? It's going to be quite straightforward because I think John is central to the story. So we're going to take a little detour when we get to his era of the Lions and find out exactly what it was like being on tour. And then, you know, obviously this tour right now, 2025, it has had some detractors. Some people thought that it wasn't going to be a strong enough Aussie side to actually warrant this Lions tour coming around. Yeah. You know how it works in social media nowadays. People will find the smallest narrative.
Yeah.
They'll put petrol on it, and they'll see how many matches they can get within an echo chamber of this. So, John, I think that the best way to start this tour, you know, like, it is the greatest tradition in rugby, basically. It started out, and I've done some notes here, but, I mean, jump in as you wish, because I know you're a big history man. 1888 was essentially the origin of the Lions Tour, because the Shaw and Shrewsbury team wanted to go south for commercial reasons.
Yep.
And back then, it was mostly English players, and it was seen as a pretty cool way to get in a boat and go tour. You know, the guys back in the day. It was always a boat.
That's how throwback this is.
But 1888, this is how far back it goes. 1910 was the first proper tour where there was actually players from the home unions. So we're talking Wales, Scotland, Ireland, England. It wasn't just a bunch of English guys. 1924, they came to South Africa. And that is where the nickname of the Lions came to be. So it wasn't, they weren't officially known as the Lions, but they had these Lions emblems on their ties. Yeah. So when they went into the official gatherings that was at, and the journalists of the day nicknamed them the Lions. 1950 though, Sandile, that was the first time where there was red jerseys. Every player was a professional, a capped international from the home unions. Yes. And that's when they became affectionately known as the Lions. So John, I think most people, when they think the British and Irish Lions, the 70s and 80s were the absolute prime.
Yeah.
1971. Lions weren't winning a huge bunch. 1971, they went to New Zealand and they won that test series in New Zealand. 1974, they came to SA, most infamous of all tests. They were unbeaten through that entire test series. Now, going back to that, you were an up-and-coming young man in the 70s. Just how big of a deal was it, the British Lions, as it was called then? How big of a deal was it growing up as a player?
It was the ultimate. You know, it was the ultimate. It was special. It was unique. And I'm delighted to say it still is unique. Mm. And I can tell you now that because you're right, there are certain people with vested interests who want to do away with the Lions. National teams are under so much pressure to break even because of salaries. Pressure from television revenue is there. We know all that sort of boring stuff behind the scenes. And there are certain officials, mostly accountants, who want to do away with the Lions, who see it as a nuisance. But I can tell you now, there would be a revolution from the players if the Lions was done away from, done away with, because it is the absolute ultimate. You know, I always think, funnily enough, an old friend of mine, Alan Lewis, Dr. Alan Lewis, Cambridge University, is the last Lions player who didn't play for his country. He was unfortunate to be a scrum half around the time of Gareth Edwards, right, who simply never got injured, or rarely, rarely injured. And I always wonder, if you said to Alan, would you rather have played for Wales and not the Lions, or the Lions and not Wales? And it's a very difficult question to answer, but that's the answer of a quiz question. Alan Lewis is the last player to fall into that group. You grew up dreaming of playing for your country. You know, I grew up almost out of the womb, and my dream was to play rugby for Ireland. I had a Welsh granddad. I used to watch rugby with him. I loved him to bits, and that's where my love of rugby came from. And you sort of dream of playing for your country, and almost the moment the whistle blows. And I can remember playing against Australia in 1976 when I was 20 years old and 3 months. And I can remember, I picked out of the blue. I mean, it's a ridiculous story. I was scared playing club rugby. Here I am playing against Australia International. And I can remember vividly, as the ball was kicked off, a thought going into my mind saying, you're 20 years of age, your life's ambition is realized. What else is there to do? And then afterwards, I thought, well, hold on, there is one little tiny thing that's almost beyond belief. Could I sneak onto a Lions tour? And that is the absolute ultimate for a rugby player. And the extraordinary thing is talking to Springboks, talking to Naas Boerter, talking to the various people that I've met on Supersport, Victor Matfield, John Smith. I remember covering a Lions series in New Zealand, the last series in New Zealand. And I couldn't believe how excited the Springboks were, even though the Springboks weren't involved, because they said it is so unusual, it is so unique, it is special. And in a funny way, I wonder, will the money men, the marketing men at some stage, try and create something in the Southern Hemisphere with New Zealand, Australia, that'll become one above their national sides? I hope not, because in a way that'll take away the uniqueness of the Lions.
Never contrived. I mean, that's the whole thing, was like, when you grow up, you always think the Lions are something different. And it's kind of cool that you can't be part of that. Sometimes inclusivity ruins a lot of things. Sometimes it's okay for certain people to have certain things. But growing up in the British Isles, I mean, from a kid though, I mean, you just said it was like a distant thought.
I've
that
I've got
maybe,
to say British Isles and Ireland.
British Isles and
okay,
sorry.
Just because otherwise people will complain
this
about it.
This is important.
You know? And yet, having said that, Ben, when I went on my tour, it was acceptable to call it the British Lions. You know, you didn't think about it. It's the Lions, it's the British Lions. And it was, in fact, the Irish journalists on my tour who insisted on saying the British and Irish Lions, which was such a mouthful. It was almost, why are you making an issue out of this? But it's accurate. So it's the BNI Lions now. But you talk about exclusivity. And sorry, I'm starting to dominate here, because I get excited and talking about the Lions, it's
carry
there.
On. I say the best shows are the ones we talk the less. Yeah. You carry on.
My best radio shows, people used to say, the ones you talk less. But anyway, you talk about inclusivity and exclusivity in the area you talked about. The beauty about the Lions, funnily enough, is not looking at the players who were British and Irish Lions. You look at the players who missed out. You look at some of the greatest rugby players of all times who were never British and Irish Lions. I mean, I think back to Jonathan Davis, the Welsh fly half. Magnificent player, an absolute legend of the game. And if you remember, at the end of amateur era, he went to rugby league and then he came back and so on. But I was at a function, not the last Lions tour, the Lions tour before that, the great one, I would say, when Mornay Steyn kicked the winning penalty. Well, he always did, but the first time. the years escape me. And I remember talking to Jonathan Davis, and he came to me, and his career was so incredible. And, you know, I had a very nice little career, but it was sort of an interesting one. And he said, you know, but, which is what the Welsh say, he said, I'm so jealous of you. And I said, what? He said, I'm so jealous of you. And he said, the reason is because you played for the Lions, and I never did. And that's that struck me. And you go back through history. I mean, I look at I'm so delighted for Andrew Porter, for example, on this tour, because he was a shoe-in for the last tour, and then he broke his toe, if you remember. And I thought he might never go on a tour. You look at players who play in the last games before a tour, and you wonder what it must be like for them. Because I remember my tour, the last few games, the British and Irish Lions didn't play. They were kept away from it because they couldn't risk missing out on the tour. So it's almost not the great players who you, when you become a Lion, you join that exclusive club. It's almost, and you look and say, I'm a Lion. And Jonathan Davis isn't a Lion. Kevin Flynn isn't a Lion. I could go through a number of names. And even talking about it, if you see the hairs on my arms.
But this is here. It, right? Like we often talk on the show that sometimes we don't see the high stakes like we used to. Again, because it's a blur. When you talk about this kind of stuff, it ignites so much like passion for so many different kind of reasons. And I want to get into the 80 tour because I just because of the pictures that we have of John back in his heyday alone, I want to show you. But I just want to touch on like where the Lions was going, okay? So we all know how it got to be and the prestige and what was at stake and what an honor it was. But they weren't a cohesive unit just yet. Now, a lot of things come into rugby with culture and how you tour and those kind of things. And this is what fascinates me most about these guys. What was it about the 70s that you felt? Because this was still you were old enough to know a lot about the inner runnings of this.
Mm.
What was it about the 70s that suddenly turned it around? They went to New Zealand and they won. They went to South Africa and they won. I know there was a particularly strong Welsh team back then. Welsh rugby in its heyday.
You're asking questions and then answering it yourself. Answer I was going to say was Wales. And youngsters following the game today, when sadly Welsh rugby is at a low, probably the lowest it's ever been. And I heard a terrifying comment the other day from my old mate Ollie Campbell, who of course is legendary, one of the greatest players that ever played the game, and I say that with no doubts. And he said he heard that in Bridgend there is not a single school playing rugby. In Wales.
Oh,
that's
wow,
where JPR Williams came, Steve Fenwick came, so many great players that they're all playing soccer now, that rugby is a little bit out the window. But that Welsh team, and it started off in the late 60s, a lot of Welsh players used to go to London to work, mainly as school teachers. And London Welsh had a side, and they had a captain called John Dawes, and they had Gerald Davis, and they had JPR Williams, and they had so many players. Mervyn Davis was there. John Taylor was there. And they started running the ball in a way which was almost unheard of in the 60s, because the early 60s was a terrible era for rugby. If you remember, they had to bring in the kick to the rule about kicking to touch. You could only kick directly to touch inside your 25, as it was then, 25-yard line. And that was because rugby was stagnating so much, they had to do something to start running the ball. Rest. And London Welsh started off doing that, and that transferred into Wales. And you look back at those Welsh players, you know, the Gareth Edwards, the Barry Johns, the JPR Williams, JJ Williams, these wonderful, wonderful players. And we looked at them in absolute awe. French rugby was always semi-professional. You know, we all knew that and it was terrific. But Welsh rugby you looked at in absolute awe. And then they were lucky in that they brought in a coach in 71. And by a guy by the name of Carwin James, who was Llanelli, and he broke the mold. He was a very, very intellectual guy. He happened to be gay, which, you know, came out later, but at the time was, I suppose, quite controversial. And he believed in giving the players their head, letting them use their skill, letting them run the ball, and that combination led to the 71 Lions. But I'll tell you something about them. Their first game was against Queensland. They used to play warm-up games, often including Australia, but on that particular tour, they played Queensland and New South Wales, and they lost their first game to Queensland. No. And the New Zealand newspaper said, this is without a doubt the worst Lions team that has ever left the shores of Britain and Ireland.
Hasty journalism at its best.
And they started off and they won a couple of games, but not very, very emphatically. And then they played Wellington, one of the strongest New Zealand provinces. And in New Zealand, they said, this will be the Lions' first defeat. And Mike Gibson, the great Mike Gibson, Irish centre and a very good friend of mine, and again, one of the absolute greatest players. And he said to me, something clicked in that game. And the Lions won 44-10 or something like
that. In the days of four points a try.
And they, three. And they went, it might even have been nil. You know, my memory's gone. But Google that particular game. And the Lions cut loose. And Mike Gibson said, they suddenly realized they were onto something. So it was the brilliant Welsh players. And then also, dotted in amongst them were some great players like Mike Gibson, like Willie John McBride, as hard as nails, like some of the English players, David Duckham, for example, who didn't start off as a test player and ended up as a test player and was one of the absolute stars of the team. Sandy Carmichael was there, then sadly got injured. The young Gordon Brown came in at lock. And suddenly you had this team based on the Welsh with other players who perhaps, and I could be in trouble for this, perhaps when they played for their own countries, they felt a little bit subdued because they were relatively weak. Mm. And suddenly playing with these Welsh players, with a coach like Carwin James, they absolutely cut loose. And even today, Google the 1971 Lions and you'll be absolutely knocked out at the standard of play.
So that's coming, I was going to bring up as like a suggestion, is that we've seen that as well. We've seen it with provincial players nowadays. They play for a certain team and they're a certain player. They put that BOC jersey on and suddenly there is so much more that enlivens you towards the encounter. So of the Lions being what they are, it must have been so great if you play for, say, Scotland or Wales, England, whatever it may be, exactly to your point, the cause was greater than their abilities almost. And that must have also been a factor in 74 because those guys came here and they seemed like they thought they were invincible.
74 was different. And again, I hate to disappoint South Africans watching this because, you know, I talk to people of my era in this country and they say the 74 Lions, how brilliant they were, marvellous, they were great. You talk to people of my generation from the UK and Ireland, and we say the 71 Lions.
Right.
Because the Springboks were not great. They'd been isolated for a fair while. Yeah. And the Lions had a pack of forwards that absolutely dominated. And they were hard men and they could be nasty. You know, they could be nasty, nasty players. And they weren't going to take any nonsense from the Springboks. Yeah. Because players before had been bullied by the Springboks and bullied by provincial sides in South Africa. And Willie John McBride and Sid Miller. Now, you had the great Lions side where they were up against a very good New Zealand side in 71 and at best got 50% of the ball, even less, 40% of the ball, and had to run it, which was why the series was so great. When they played against South Africa in 74, they smashed the Springboks up front. They smashed every team up front. And I remember Mornay du Plessis chatting to him about it because he was a youngster coming into the Springbok ranks. And they were at a team meeting before the test match. And he said, he put his hand up and said, guys, the Lions scrum is very, very strong. And I think we should have a discussion about how to deal with this. Maybe look at channel one ball, maybe getting it in and out very, very quickly. And he told me, Johan Claassen said to him, Mornay, don't worry, the Springbok jersey never goes backwards.
Right.
You know, and there was that sort of mythology around the Springboks.
And that's what happens when you're in isolation, though.
In isolation, exactly. And this, the crazy thing was in that first test in 74, down in Cape Town, which the Lions won 12-3, Gareth Edwards dropped an amazing goal out of the mud. There were no tries scored. And the Springboks actually did quite well, but such was the shock of losing that, of course, they panicked. And they changed the team dramatically. And then they panicked again. And the story even went, I don't know if it's apocryphal, that they actually ran out of material to make Springbok blazers because they'd given so many blazers on the particular tour. So 71 was the key. 74 was almost the reward where they smashed their way through. And then, of course, the third test, the Springboks having been beaten, then hammered, and they decided to pick a team that was going to take on the Springboks, and it's called the Battle of Boot Erasmus. And if you look, if you Google that, you'll see events on the field that today wouldn't have led to red cards. They would have led to arrests and people being put in jail.
Exactly, yeah. Assault.
It is pure incredible. Assault. And so I grew up as a youngster. I was in school for 71. I just started playing club rugby in 74. And those were my absolute heroes.
So you speak about 60s rugby being quite boring, not much running.
Until the late 60s, they introduced that rule.
But I kind of feel like when I look back now on these kind of things, it's like those two tours made rugby like that real hard man's kind of game. People were looking at it like, okay, there's skill, but look at these oaks. They are brutal. As you say, the 99 call and the violence, those kind of things. It's like that was to me the peak of rugby being the hard man sport. But now, going back to your story, okay, so now just beating those guys, 1980 is the tour. Yes. You make the squad.
No, I don't make the squad.
Sorry, you were in Rhodesia at the time playing rugby. I forget that point.
Again, gosh, my story is so crazy. Having got picked for Ireland, having played one provincial game, having not played in the Irish trial a couple of weeks before, there were four scrum halves ahead of me. Then the selectors got together and picked a training group to train the week before the day after the Irish trial. The Irish trial was there. There were two scrum halves picked in the teams, two reserve scrum halves. I wasn't selected. I paid my $5 at the gate and went and watched the trial. And I was just 20 years of age. In fact, I was 19 at the trial. I was just 20 years of age. And then they announced that evening a training squad for the next day. And from that, after dinner that night, they were going to pick the team. And they announced the training squad, and I wasn't in the training squad. And I was down at my local pub with my friends watching Match of the Day on the soccer, and I got a phone call to my dad said, we've had a phone call from Rowley Meats, the Irish coach. You've got to come home. He's going to phone you in a quarter of an hour's time. And I thought to myself, maybe one of the training squad has got injured, a scrum half, and I might be called into the training squad. And maybe I'll get a tracksuit. I thought, oh, wouldn't that be lovely to get a tracksuit in those old amateur days? Yeah. And I came home and Rowley Mead's phone. And he said, John, how are you? And I said, how are you, Rowley? He said, good news, you're playing against Australia. So I wasn't in the top four scrum halves before tea time. Yeah. After tea time, I was in the test side. And they must have had a few Guinnesses. I think in that tea time, and to this day, I still don't know what happened. Yeah. So anyway, I was in as a bright young player, and we were bad. Ireland were poor at that time, and we used to joke that if we won the toss, we did a lap of honour. That was the big joke about the Irish team. And there's another great story about legendary Moss Keane, the lock forward from Ireland, running out against England at Twickenham, and Tony Neary, the English flank and captain, said to him, oh, "May the best team win, Moss," as they ran out. And Moss said, "I hope not." You know, that was the sort of situation, and I was in and out of the side. But in 1977, the next year, the Lions were going to New Zealand, and we lost to Scotland 21-18. Gareth Edwards had said he wasn't going to tour, so Bryn Mawr-Williams, his reserve for Wales, was a shoo-in. So we all knew that the next scrum half, you know, would come from another country. And Dougie Morgan was a brilliant Scottish scrum half. Now, even though we lost to Australia, to Scotland, it was deemed somehow I'd had a good game. I made a break and set up a try for Mike Gibson. And they said, you've played well. So there was a month to go for the last test of the Six Nations, or Five Nations then. We were playing against France at Lansdowne Road. And Wales were playing Scotland at Murrayfield. And I never trained so hard. In those days, we trained twice a week and maybe went for a run on Sunday. And I trained every single day. Every single day, I was running, passing, dropping goals. And the game against France arrived. This was my chance to go on a Lions tour. And funnily enough, I found it on YouTube recently, the game with French commentators. Yeah. And we kicked off and we tore into the French. And I missed a drop goal and I got a couple of passes away. And then I made a half break, and I broke my leg, snapped my leg. 5 minutes, I thought my life was over. My tour was gone, etc., and I thought that was it. And then I didn't play for Ireland for 4 years. Then in 1980, In those days, believe it or not, they thought that televised rugby would take away from the crowds. So there was very little rugby televised. There were the test matches in the Six Nations, Five Nations, sorry, then. There was the varsity match. And then for some reason on Easter Sunday, they used to show the Barbarians against Cardiff. The Barbarians used to go on an Easter tour and play four games in 6 days. And it was a huge honor to get on that Barbarians team. And I was selected on that. And I played against Cardiff and had one of those games where everything worked. Yeah. And then they told me, you're reserved for the Lions. And then I toured Romania with Leinster. Romania were one of the strongest sides in the world. They were fully, fully professional athletes when we were amateurs. Came back and got an offer to go to, it was then, I think, Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, or Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. It was the changeover to democracy. And I got an offer to go and play, go for a week to Zim and play against the Quokkas for the Goshawks. And I'm warming up in the dressing room before the game, looking at the size of these giants. And a head popped around the door and it said, John, the Lions had been in South Africa for a couple of weeks. We got a message from Sid Miller. Terry Holmes is injured, Welsh scrum half. You have to play the game and then you have to join the Lions in South Africa.
You prefer to hear that after the game?
I passed the ball. I never tackled anything. And then flew down, and I'll never forget getting on a plane to Joburg and then getting a plane to Cape Town and then being met at Cape Town and a mad dash out to Stellenbosch. It actually opened the Donny Craven Stadium at Kutzenberg. They played against the Leopards. And I arrived just before kickoff, and Billy Beaumont and Sid Miller met me. Sid Miller shook my hand and he said, from this moment, even if you never play a game, because I was a temporary replacement, and he said, even if you never play a game, you're as much a British and Irish Lion as Willie John McBride, who went on five tours.
Wow. Yeah.
And I've never forgotten that. And sadly, they've changed that rule now. Nowadays, you have to appear on the field in a Lions jersey. And the reason for that was, you might remember, with the shortened tours, they were in New Zealand and they needed some replacements for the final test. And Wales happened to be in Australia. Mm-hmm. So they flew a few Welsh guys out who sat on the bench. And unless they actually got on the pitch, they're not Lions, which is crazy. Yeah. So I have a problem with that because it goes against, because you always have to be lucky to be a Lion. You have to be informed, depending on the coach, that, you know, whatever. And I think that's something they've got slightly wrong. But that's the story. That's my story in a nutshell.
John, I wanted to ask, and you know, you talk about the culture, and we've been talking about the culture of touring with the Lions, and you talked about how you've had lifelong relationships with some of the guys. Can you just give us a little bit of an eye shot on how that culture is built, what you guys are up to outside of rugby, and how these lifelong relationships and friendships go on?
It's a great question, and it's changed dramatically, and yet there's a link. And this is something that struck me when I heard, when Mario Itoje went on his first tour, and he was the youngster. And what they do now is, starting from, I think, the 1959 Lions, when they run out, the captain on the day carries a Lion mascot, which used to be called Leo, and now it's called Bill, B-I-L, British and Irish Lion. They carry the Lion out, and that's a tradition. And the youngest player on the tour has to look out for the mosque, and my goodness, if he loses it. And there's all sorts of jokes about people stealing it, and he thinks he's in trouble. And Mario Itoje said on that tour, he said, bear in mind, he's a full professional, you know, serious athlete. And he said on that tour, he said, you know, I've never drunk so much in my life. Right? I've never, because we have these bonding sessions.
Right.
Guys you hate from other countries, you suddenly, you've got to become mates with. They have sing songs. They have all these traditions. And it struck me that in our day, when we were amateurs, and as I say, we trained twice a week, and rugby was very much a passion and a sideshow to your to your job.
Sure.
And it struck me that in our day, we got to experience for a couple of months life as a professional sportsman, because we were totally looked after. You only had to think about rugby and enjoying yourself. You trained every single day and you were treated like a superstar, right, particularly in South Africa in the days of isolation and the days of apartheid. And let me nail my colors to the wall. We were wrong to come. And I'm ashamed of coming in those days, But having said that, I can't deny from a rugby point of view, it was an absolute highlight. But I want to say that and nail my colours to the wall, lest people think I'm hiding it. So we were, and it was unbelievable. I've never been so fit in my life. You'd walk out of the hotel, there's people asking for autographs. When we were on that tour, I remember Dave Sexton, the manager of Manchester United, Steve Highway of Liverpool, and one of the Nottingham Forest players were there doing some coaching. And I remember they could walk out of the hotel and no one knew who they were. We as the Lions would walk out and there would be a riot, you know. So we had this incredible experience of being professional superstar sportsmen. Nowadays, ironically, the Lions have the experience of being amateurs on a tour where they can let the hair down and,
so well put,
and build. Yeah. And it struck me that it was a wonderful way of us to look into the future and they can almost look backwards.
Yeah.
And they've said that that's why they're it's such a pleasure to do it, yeah. You know? So, I mean, coming to South Africa in those days, honestly, if you woke up in the morning and you went training and you said, God, I'd love to meet Gary Player, yeah, which happened to four of us,
yeah,
it would be arranged. If you got up in the morning and said...
Sorry, John, hang on a second there. Wendy, I think there's actually a picture there. It'd probably be the black and white slide. You must... Sorry. Like,
there you are.
So there's John and his mates actually meeting Gezza.
Gary Player. That's a driver made of lead. So you can hardly lift it. And Gary Player said...
He's always got that...
He always got that one. He said, if any of you can do this, I will give you my ranch. His ranch up in Honeydew. So that's Peter Wheeler, the English hooker. That's a youthful myself. That's Andy Irvine, one of the greatest players that ever played the game. And that is Sir Clive Woodward with the long curly hair. Now he's like me, bald as a coot.
Sir Clive, who went on to give England the only World Cup they've ever won.
That's right.
He was a player on your tour.
And a knighted. Yeah, I roomed with him, Clive Woodward. A magnificent, magnificent player. In fact, that's a heck of a group. And you can see the T-shirt I'm wearing. They arranged for us to go to, I think, the Adidas factory, and we could literally help ourselves.
Yeah.
Someone said they wanted to meet Gary Player. It was arranged for us. If you got up in the morning and said, I'd like to go up in a helicopter, they would arrange for you to go up in a helicopter.
Oh, wow.
If you got, it was unbelievable. It was incredible. In fact, your biggest problem was walking down the street because people would see who you were and they would mob you. I remember Bill Haley and the Comets were playing at the Coliseum in Johannesburg. The founder of rock and roll, or one of the great founders of rock and roll. And somebody said, would you guys like to go? And it was fantastic. It was sold out down in the Coliseum. And three of us went. Ollie Campbell, myself, and Tony Ward went to that. I'll never forget because somebody offered us a Zoll when we were at the thing. You know, I've never seen this before. And yeah. we didn't take it, you know. But I remember it was such a good concert, I said, and they, you know, moved heaven and earth to get us tickets. And I said, God, I'd love to see that again. So they arranged the next night we went to watch it again. They obviously threw somebody out of seats or something. It came again. I remember down in the who was the other singer? Who was Matt Munro, the great singer, Born Free, the man who sang Born Free.
Right.
He was known as England's Frank Sinatra, the singing bus driver.
Right.
And he was playing at the
Big call.
He started life as a bus driver, so he was a singing bus driver. And it was very funny because, you don't mind me telling these old stories.
Are you sure? This is why we're here for.
Are
it.
You like sure?
I'm guiding you into certain things here.
Yeah. But I remember we were at the hotel, the Beverly Hills Hotel down in Umhlanga, and Matt Munro was there. And our manager... our doctor was Jackie Matthews.
That was Saul Kersner's first hotel.
That's right. Everyone said, nobody will go so far out of Durban. Yeah. You're mad. And of course, it's a fabulous hotel. And Matt Munro was singing, and our doctor was Jackie Matthews, who'd been on the 1950 Lions, Bleden Williams and himself were the two best centres probably in the world at that time. And he'd gone on to be a doctor, so he was our doctor in the Lions. And he was a fabulous guy. And he'd met Matt Munro years before. So he went the night before we went to the concert, and he sat up having a few drinks with Matt Munro. And the few drinks turned into many drinks. And late in the evening, or in fact late in the morning, Matt Munro fell off his bar stool and he tore his rib cartilage, right? And the next night at the concert, he sang that famous song, Born Free. And I don't know if you know, at the end of it, he goes, born, that high note, and he hits the note. And I'll never forget the newspapers in South Africa said, even after all these years of singing the song, the emotion got so much to Matt Monro, he couldn't make that high note. And we knew the real reason was that he's torn his rib cartilage, falling off the chair with Jackie Matthews. So that gives you a clue to it. Yeah. But having said that, the rugby was also serious.
Yeah.
The rugby was serious. And the other thing, and this is an interesting one, and maybe I'm preempting you on this one, Ben, but the key to a Lions tour is the B team, is the dirt trackers. Because if you split it into the test team, and this is where Clive Woodward went so wrong in 2005 in New Zealand, he'd fly the test team, or he'd fly the dirt trackers down to play against Poverty Bay and leave the test team. Mm. And if the dirt trackers feel that they're not part of it, then the team spirit can absolutely split and can deteriorate. And on our tour, Billy Beaumont and Sid Miller and Coach Noel Murphy, we were always, because I was one of the dirt trackers until the last couple of weeks of the tour, we were always made to feel a part of it. And if you look at the great 74 team, probably the greatest, after the 71, in terms of results, the greatest team was 74. After that famous third test, infamous third test, when the Lions won the series, the first team, the test team, lined up in front of the grandstand and applauded the dirt trackers who were sitting there in their blazers and said, you're as much a part of this. And I would say that particularly on this Lions tour now, where you've got so many Irishmen and you've got the Irish coach, who's there, Andy Farrell, if there's ever a sense that the Irish are the first team that they're somehow being favoured, then that can destroy the team spirit immediately. And that, I think, is the most important thing on a Lions tour, that it's either a united group or it's not.
Seems so weird that Clive Woodward, being a Lions touring person, would have done something.
Isn't that
like
interesting?
That.
Yeah.
But I guess I almost feel like, you know, his tenure in England was so good, but it fell away so much because he was so analytical. I think he got overly...
Woody was always bonkers. You know, he was a genius player. Yeah. But for example, when and I'm not taking away from it all because, you know, he's achieved, it's there. Cool. But for example, when he was coach of London Irish, he had this theory that somehow the numbers on the player's back had some sort of influence. So he'd take the field with the scrum half wearing number 15. He had this bonkers theory that mixing up the numbers. And the one thing he did was... he gave the players power. You know, they had Martin Johnson. They had a mean and nasty pack of forwards. They had Johnny Wilkinson at fly half, and they had some very good Will Greenwood, perhaps one of the lesser known players, but was absolutely key to that that tour. And for example, the players could travel first class. For example, their wives and families were looked after. For example, and the worst thing on a rugby team ever, far worse than anything else, is if you get a roommate who snores. All right? If you get a roommate who snores.
That's one of your questions last week.
I kid you not. And there was one Springbok player who always had a room on his own because he snored so much. And they said this, I'm not going to name who it is, but they said it was John Fillette of Western Province. Yeah. And the Western Province guy said, we are not going to share a room with that guy. So Clive Woodward, for example, gave the guys room. In other words, he said, look, I'm going to give you everything you want, but you have to deliver. And then under Martin Johnson, they did. But that picture of young Clive Woodward, he scored a try against, he had a game against the Transvaal, and they had a tough side. And we played at the Wanderers Cricket Stadium because Ellis Park was being rebuilt. Right. And so, in fact, Rodney O'Donnell, our fullback, broke his neck. Playing against the Junior Springboks and never played again at the Wanderers Cricket Stadium. And I had a guest out from Ireland recently who knows him, and I actually took him to the spot and said that's where Rodney's career ended. But Clive Woodward on that day just showed what a talent he was. And sadly wasn't used because our back line on that 82 wasn't really used. And we had a lot of injuries and so on. But
Yeah, just to kind of bring it up, we got some more pictures there because it was a tour that was marred by injuries. I mean, your story of how you came into it was because there were injuries.
Oh, yeah.
So there's John in the far right looking a bit forlorn after a loss.
No, that's after a win, actually. That would be...
So every game you played, you won. You were a lucky charm on this tour.
Yeah, because having never won a game for Ireland, yes, having played nine tests for Ireland. Thank you very much for bringing that up, Ben. In fact, it's ruined. It's actually ruined my best story because I love telling the story about how I lost 9 out of 9. Yeah. I'm the most consistent rugby player in the history of rugby. And now, I don't know if you're aware, they've righted a historic wrong about rugby. There were a number of Irish players. Brian O'Driscoll's dad, Frank, was one of them, who played against Argentina or played against Fiji or played against those sides, Italy, and they never gave caps. And now, years later, 50 years later, they've said this is wrong. It's not who you play against. It's who you play for.
Yeah, sure. Yes,
and 12 of them have been given international caps now, and Scotland have followed suit. So Brian O'Driscoll's dad, Frank, got his international cap 20 years after his son did, which I think is a lovely story.
Special day that had that one.
Where was I going with that particular story? I can't remember.
Play for Ireland?
I was going... Yes, my great story. Sorry, they've ruined my great story because... A game I played in 1980 against Romania is now an official game, and we drew 10-all. So I've got 9 losses out of 10, which is wonderful because I'm not 100% lost, but it's also terrible because it's ruined my...
So you played, what was it, 6 games in total on that tour, including the fourth test?
No, I think I played 7.
7.
I think 7 and won every game and then got selected for the final test, which was wonderful. And traditionally, the last test on a tour is the hardest.
Yes.
Because with the best will in the world, you're packing, you've got to pack, you've got to buy presents, you're dying to get home. You know, you really are. You've been on tour a long time. And very, very few touring teams have won the last test. And even though it was a magnificent series, this one, who is that youngster on the left?
Hey, oh, full hit of hair.
Look right at the hair. We actually won that last test, which was terrific. But you look at that picture there, and gosh, there's on the right, that's Ray Gravel, the centre, who's dead. That's Colm Tucker, the flank is dead. That's Morris Colclough, the lock, who's dead. That's the Springbok flank, who is dead. So you look back.
You sound like Gary Player here.
Yeah, no. God, that's unbelievable. And there's little me, that scared scrum half, about to ping it off his left hand, which is quite interesting.
You look at results, okay? Springboks won this one 3-1, but those were tight games. Were super tight games that could have really gone either way.
Boy, was it tight. First test was 24-all, and Divan Serfontein scored in the last minute. The second test, the Springboks won 26-19 or something, and beat us well in Bloemfontein. Casey Pina had a... unbelievable game and scored a try. Do you remember he held the ball up? There's that famous photo of him after scoring the try. And then the third test was played in the rain in Port Elizabeth, pouring rain. And that was the one where Clive Woodward tapped the ball into touch and turned away. And Hermeses did the quick throw in. And Nas converted from the corner and they won 12-10, I think. And so it was 3-0 down. And then we won the last 17-13. So it was a wonderful series, and there was no animosity between the teams because Mornay was their captain and Billy Beaumont was our captain. And we had Sid Miller as a manager and Noel Murphy, who were all absolutely imbued with the spirit of rugby and of friendship.
Yeah.
And it was terrific, you know.
But it was a great tour in other respects. I mean, the non-test matches, you guys won all of those. But those are still tough games, right? They were still strong. Boy. So the guys who played for the Springboks would still play their provincial teams, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we played something like 17 games on the tour. Now they play like 7 warm-up games or something. And in the old days, they used to be away for 3 months. They'd play like 30 games, which was absolutely extraordinary. But it was lovely. And I mean, I having thought my... Lions career was never going to happen after breaking my leg in 1977. Just to get that call, just to put that jersey on, was the height of my rugby ambition. And so I didn't care. And I said to them, I'll carry the bag. I remember going to Terry Holmes and saying, look, Terry, you're a better player than I am. I didn't do it to Colin Patterson because he was my Irish nemesis. But I said, if you need help with the passing, you know, exercises, whatever. I'm happy to do it. I would have carried the bags on that tour. And I was so happy to hear who's the English, the New Zealander who played for England. No, the English guy, Hoskins, is it, on the last tour. And he got picked as a replacement and came out and he said exactly the same thing. He became a Lion. I'll carry the bags. I'll clean your boots. I don't care. Because I've ticked that box. And before I leave, guys, I must just show you this, because this is my proudest possession. Sheesh. And I'm going to show you this. And I'm going to show it to you.
Oh, wow.
Because this is something that they only brought out a couple of years ago. Having international caps, believe it or not, in the early years of rugby, they didn't have different jerseys. And the players' teams were decided by their hats that they wore. All right? That's how a rugby was. So that's where the international cap came. And every team gives international caps, but the Lions never did. And then about, 10 years ago, they found all the players or families of all the Lions. And they gave us in this magnificent, you can...
Are you Lion 5? Are you Lion
number 574? Yeah.
Oh, John, that must have been an absolute win. Hey, you drew it with Romania and then you got the Lions recognition. Yeah. I mean,
but have a look at that. Something.
That is so beautiful.
It's velvet, it's done. Oh, oops.
This is amazing. And it cannot be bought. It is literally priceless.
It cannot be bought. And when they gave them, they just crossed. And you got some of them were old men in their
80s. Yeah.
You know, who'd never seen it before, and when this arrived, and my son will get that someday.
Yes.
I would think, and it's very special. Oh, and if ever I'm feeling a bit down about something, I just go and look at that.
Oh.
And I
think because of what it represents, exactly. This is why I wanted to have this chat, like to get to the sort of like the texture of what it is about this whole jersey.
Yeah, yeah.
So from there, obviously the last amateur tour was '93, right? '97 when the Lions came to South Africa for the first time post. And the Springboks didn't decide not to bring a kicker into the squad.
Exactly. Not the cleverest thing. And amazingly, one of the guys was Percy Montgomery, who missed a lot of kicks and then ended up becoming one of the best kickers in the world. In fact, I think he...
Because he went to Wales.
I think for whatever reason, you know, people talk about kickers and we talk about guys who are inconsistent and will they come right, won't they come right. Very rarely does a guy go from being hit and hope into, you know, because you don't want a kicker who'll kick you 6 out of 6 one week and none out of 6 the next. You want a guy who'll kick you 5 out of 6 every single week in and out. And I think Percy is probably one of the only people in rugby who's gone from being hit and hope to being one of the best in the world. And that's to his absolute credit.
Percy and Marnie Leboeck in 2 years' time.
I was going to say, I wasn't going to drag Marnie Leboeck into this today.
I didn't think he was going to be here either. All right, John, we've got to look at the tour that's coming up now. So we're going to split into two because it's already happening. June 20th, there it is. The Argentinians are being brought in for a sort of curtain raiser here.
Mm.
Start with a bang. When the Lions came here last time, they played Japan. So it's not a completely weird thing to be playing a non-tour team, so to speak.
And relatively new. Relatively new.
Relatively new, yeah.
Clive Woodward, I think they played Argentina as well and drew with them. And it's a good idea. I like it. And, of course, they're playing in Ireland.
So for a lot of South Africans, they wouldn't have watched a lot of Super Rugby. But straight up, this first month is about getting the shine off the ball here. They're taking on all the Super Rugby teams. Then they've got an invitational Aussie and New Zealand team versus the Lions.
Oof.
Then we've got the test matches proper. Okay, so what happens here is that John talks about the dirt trackers, as you see by the games there.
Yep.
We're looking 2 a week here. Yep. So we've got the Wednesday sort of Saturday split, as is tradition. Pop the next slide up there. And now we go into the actual test matches. So, John, before we get into like the breaking down game for game here, obviously the Wallabies have gone through a bit of a trough. We've all known for the peaks.
Mm.
Trough's been experienced. Say what you want, Eddie Jones, World Cups, waning interest in rugby union, whatever it may be. What's your sort of gut feeling about the Wallabies team right now under Joe Schmidt and what they're bringing to these series of fixtures?
I think they're coming to the boil very nicely. And I think nobody is more fed up with the state of Australian rugby than Australian rugby players, rugby people. And also the Australians are the greatest fans ever. And I'll give you proof of that. When they had the World Cup over there, there was one fixture that nowadays, with no disrespect, would be regarded as the worst and least attractive fixture in the whole of the World Cup. That was Namibia against Romania being played in Tasmania. Now, it almost has got a poetic twist to it. Now, if you paid me, I wouldn't want to go to that game, all right? So what they did was the Australians said, no, it's our World Cup, we must support. So what they said was, everybody in Hobart whose number of their house is odd is a Romanian fan. Everyone who's got an even number is a Namibian fan. They had kids learning the national anthems. They made posters, whatever. They filled the stadium in Hobart, and they did it. So the Aussies, same with the World Cup, same with the Olympics. Do you remember the volunteers at the Olympics? Mm-hmm. There were thousands and thousands of them. So when it comes to national pride, the Aussies will step up. And everybody is delighted to see the Australians are now getting competitive. I mean, they had that recent tour. They won some games. They lost some games narrowly. And even if you look at Super Rugby or whatever the heck it's called now, I can't remember, but you will see the Aussie teams are competitive. They might still lose to the New Zealand side. Yeah. And they've got this Suwali coming in now from Rugby League, one of the hottest talents in world rugby.
And he's gone, exactly what we said last year. Oh. Then you bring some Rugby League guys in. They need to the stars.
But you bring this guy in and he gets his first rugby union game since school, playing for Australia against England, and he ends up as man of the match. Now, I know he's got a broken jaw or something like that, but he'll be back. The big question, of course, is up front, scrummaging. That's never been a strength of the Australia. Well, until 1984, when Alan Jones came in briefly and they did the Grand Slam tour, and they pushed Wales back, who'd considered themselves one of the strongest scrummaging teams in the world, and they got a pushover try in Cardiff. That's another memory that I have. But the Aussies are there, and they're fed. It's like when Rassie took over the Springboks. You get a stage where you're fed up being criticised, being mocked, being insulted.
That's a good point,
and the Aussies are like that. And you have a look at it. You know, the boxes they tick. They've got running fullbacks. They've got centres who can tackle. They've got speed on the wing. The scrummaging is there, but they've got big fellas who'll win the line out. They've got back row who can run, who can tackle, who can take on. They've got goal kickers. The one question is going to be scrummaging, because nowadays, and we learnt this from, well, in particular, the World Cup final in Japan against England. If you're going backwards in the scrum, that first scrum, it's very difficult to win a game. Yep. Because you either get a penalty and kick a goal, or you get a penalty and kick to the corner and push over. And it's hell of a difficult.
Yeah.
But there's no love lost between the Poms and the Aussies as well. So I think there'll be an element of needle in the series. Nowadays, you get press coverage that is insane. It's absolute insanity. So there will be a controversy that is contrived at some stage that will lead to this bad blood coming through. But looking at that fixture list is extraordinary, because traditionally, when the tour started getting shorter, the touring side would insist. You remember the great South African 15s or New Zealand select, Maori select teams? Yeah. The idea was we don't want these hard games coming up to the tests, and the Lions would lose the series. And then it was the team that went to New Zealand, the second before last, where they said, no, we've got this wrong. Warren Gatland, we want tough games. It's so short, we've got to have test matches leading up to the test match. And every one of those games is a tough game. And they'll be prepared. They'll be disappointed, but prepared to lose a game or two. It doesn't matter, because it comes down to the test matches.
Yeah, so the obvious thing with the so-called modern tours is that your guys who are Wallabies for the Reds or the Force or the Waratahs, they won't be playing these games.
I'm not sure.
Or if they're coming back from injury, or they need game time.
Had they said that? Because early on in the last tour to New Zealand, they did play some of the All Blacks. They did play players who are in contention.
But I guess when you play the Crusaders, they already had some All Blacks anyway.
Maybe. But that will depend on what the Australians think about it. But having said that, if you're in a team and you didn't get picked for the Wallabies, and you're replacing the guy who's in the Wallabies, my God, there's a motivation to play.
Absolutely.
You know, so
fired up. Again, it's the power of the Lions jersey. These games, even if those aren't the Wallabies playing there, those are huge games. These are career highlights
Pacifica
for all of these players.
Pacifica 15 and the other one, the combined Australia-New Zealand side. I mean, that's almost what we talked about earlier, a team above New Zealand or in Australia. That's almost copying the Lions.
Yep.
I love that. And for this part of the Australasia tour, whether it's New Zealand or Australia they go to, that game should always be there.
Yeah, that, I mean, that it could become a great fixture.
It's
yeah.
a really, really cool fixture.
Like the Barbarians being the last game on a long tour to the UK.
Yeah.
It started off to raise money, believe it or not, and it ended up becoming a wonderful tradition and feature. Wow.
So, John, I got to ask you a couple of tough questions to finish off here. First up, would you change anything about the modern tours? And the reason I ask this is because of current player workloads and current player schedules. If we look at the Lions Tour in isolation, it's beautiful. I wouldn't touch a single thing. But is there anything that you would change just to make sure that these games are going to be high stakes and the tour is going to always be really exciting?
Well, I'd change the whole of rugby because there's too much rugby. It's ridiculous. There's too much rugby. It is ridiculous. Yes.
John, and, thank you so much for saying
that. No, it's crazy. You know, I get to the stage now where I turn on and I see some game of rugby, whether it's here, whether it's Europe, whether it's... And I sort of say, oh, does it really matter? And I'll say, well, there's the boxing from last night or there's the Diamond League or something. Yeah. And I'll you know, I haven't quite got to Big Brother yet or anything of that.
You're not missing out much, though.
Crap, you know. But I've got to a stage where you almost don't care till... So it's far, far too much. And lest people say, oh, yes, 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 but we need to fund the players and the salaries and everything like that. You look at the NFL. You look at the NFL where they play... What, I don't know, 15 games, something like that. Every single game is played in front of a packed house. Every single game is like a final. Yeah. And I say, why can't we do that with
rugby? You're speaking our language. I mean, I think this year alone, we've had four shows. We've broken this down. Yeah.
No, it's crazy. Now, admittedly, I'm not I'm not paying the bills.
Yes.
But I still think less is more. And if you've got a game that is going to attract a billion people watching, surely your television rights can cover 10 games that we're going to bring in.
It's a clear thing.
Yeah, it really is. But, you know, I mean, the intricacies, it's like populist politicians like Donald Trump and Julius and Boris Johnson. You can stand up and make, you know, bold statements. Vote for me and I'll set you free. But when it comes down to the nitty gritty, maybe there are reasons you have to have that. But just as somebody who all his life has been totally passionate about the game of rugby, there is too much. And I never thought I would ever have said that. But it's now ridiculous. And so you ask about the Lions. Within that jigsaw, there has to be less.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love the long tours. And it's great that they're going to have a tour now where the Springboks go and the All Blacks go and we'll have a longer tour.
This is exactly the point I want to bring up here, is that the Lions Tour reminds us how great tours are. And now we're seeing that now. Because I'm all for Argentina, all these other teams to get better. But what I want to see the most every single year, Springboks, All Blacks.
Yeah,
and I want to see a tour where they go down.
I don't want to see it every year. I would like to see it every 3 years.
Precisely.
I would like. I mean, I can tell you, and it's obvious chatting, and maybe didn't say it to you, but I was thinking, get me talking about the 70s. Get me talking about the 80s when I played. But don't get me talking about 3 years. 3 years ago, who did the Australians? Did we beat them? I can tell you back from before I was alive, the series and the results, because they were so amazing. I remember sitting as a kid at Lansdowne Road watching the All Blacks run onto the field. The All Black jersey that I'd read so much about, it was a moment that I can remember now. And yet now, nowadays, All Blacks, we play again. Does it really matter outside a World Cup? Who
Ireland are playing All Blacks in Chicago and this game here to make some money for this. And it's a blur. It's a blur.
You have to pay the salaries. And the point I'm making is, I don't want to be simplistic and, you know, the people running rugby might come up and say, my goodness, but American football can do it. Why not?
They make the most money.
Exactly.
Those guys get a lot more. Yeah,
and who knows then? Maybe that will bring back club rugby. Maybe people will go for fun to watch club rugby, to be involved in with their families at the Wanderers. I played for the Wanderers when we had maybe one of the strongest club teams in the country. I used to joke we'd win the Six Nations.
Oh.
That Wanderers side, absolutely. Cool. It was fantastic.
Heard some tall stories at Wanderers bar. Yeah. That's the least of them.
but yeah, I mean, this is what rugby has to deal with. And I don't. Well, of course, you're aware of it. There are rumours of a rebel rugby circus. Mike Tyndall, coming in, trying to do what every other sport is trying to do, which is copy the IPL and T20 and cricket.
Yeah.
And the IPL has found a place, but it's taken away from other parts. 100% other parts of it. You know, when you get a guy like Quinton de Kock saying he doesn't want to play for South Africa anymore, but is happy to make gazillions. Yeah. There. And I'm not blaming Quinton at all, who I've known since he was 2 weeks old, by the way. But you know, you can't blame the player for looking after security.
Yeah.
But in terms of the actual game, it has damaged the traditional game. And where rugby is at the moment, when I heard Mike Tindall talking about having franchises in America and here and there and whatever, don't think it can't happen.
Yep.
And rugby has to make itself the go-to place. And as I said to you before, unless it's a Lions tour or a big international game or a final, if I see rugby on, sometimes I'll turn over.
You get no fight for me on that. That's pretty much how I do as well. Yeah, I just think that to go back to see what this thing's about, people will watch this. It's like, oh, the tours, they're so expensive, blah, blah, blah. Look how much money comes into the countries that go. Look how many people are going to travel for these things. We've got to make rugby rugby.
Yeah.
Always focus on the most important thing.
Yeah.
And we can learn so much from these tours. So I wouldn't change a single thing with the Lions tour. I would have everything in rugby changed away from these things. It's like people nowadays talk about the Monaco Grand Prix being, it should take it off the circuit. No, Monaco Grand Prix has got worse because the cars have got bigger.
Mm.
So in the past, you'd be able to overtake and have racing lines. You can't anymore because the car is just wider.
Huge, yeah.
It's not Monaco's fault. The sport has kind of lost its
roots. But I'm not a Formula One man, but I used to be. Because how can a sport exist when the main excitement is when the people go in to change tires or when it's pouring with rain? You know, how can that be a sport? So change it somewhere. Bring it along. And let me go back to what we talked about right at the beginning. In the 60s, the early 60s, rugby was dying. It was such a shocking game.
Yeah.
And then they said, we have to do something. And they came up with this rule, which was called the Australian Dispensation, because Australian rugby had started it as an experiment that said you could only kick direct to touch inside your own 22. Yeah. And suddenly you had H.O. de Villiers running from the back. Suddenly you had J.P.R. Williams running from the back. Suddenly you had Andy Irvine coming on the scene as a youngster running from the back. And it totally, totally changed and galvanized rugby. But there has to be real thought going into it.
Yeah.
And you know, there's always that rule of unintended consequences. For example, when to create attacking rugby, they brought in this use it or lose it rule, which made the team that goes into a contact almost certain to retain the ball, hoping to lead to more expansive play. And what did it lead to? It would lead to the opposition not contesting a ruck and spreading out. And so what was intended to make the game more exciting and expansive led to more and more defensive rugby, less space. So you have to experiment with these things. You have to think about it. But there's no reason you can't change.
Yeah, I just think we need to celebrate rugby. Celebrate rugby and what's good for it, and then look back from there. This whole thing that you brought up, and you're right, bills have to be paid and all these kind of things. I think there's been a lot of superfluous people in the mix who now need to get paid who aren't adding to the sport. It's like you can, you know, if you were to do like an Elon Doge and cut the cop, there's a lot of money that doesn't need to be paid to certain people who aren't actually adding to the game of rugby.
Well, let's not talk about selling the Springboks, all right?
No.
And contracts and commissions and things like that.
I'm absolutely not doing that, but we've got to celebrate what rugby is and just cut the fat a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay, final question on this. Because, I mean, I having someone like you on the show is actually dangerous because this is like...
we could just go on.
We could go hours and hours here.
Yeah.
So the Lions tours of the 70s, some of the greatest drinking stories you've ever come across. And again, go onto YouTube. As John said, that game he played against France is on YouTube. Everything's on YouTube. Like we met Alan Donald here.
Yeah.
All his games were on YouTube as well.
Everyone, yeah.
So drinking was a huge thing because how it binds you. A lot of... I think even in the early sort of pro days, some of the players were shocked that as you get there, you would meet at a hotel, everyone gets hammered together. Because the Ryder Cup do this with Europe.
Mm.
That's why they're better than the Americans. They just gel right off the bat because they're sinking a few drafts together.
Yeah.
Nowadays, though, you got these tours where you've already come off a very long season. You've got a very tough playing schedule.
Mm.
And to be very boring about this, alcohol leads to inflammation. So you can't be on the piss all the way through because you've got a game the next week. You've just come out. An ice bath's not going to do it. Do you feel that it is both the culture maybe a bit watered down now as far as how players are being brought up, or is it just people are just more serious about the professions now that we're not seeing the big drinking
culture. I think it's the latter. I think it's the latter. And as I said about the modern tours giving an insight into the old amateur days, it was never as bad on the old days. I mean, let me give you an example. In 1974, when they run the series, the Lions went to the Kruger Park for a week and they stayed in Rondavels.
Yeah, I remember that video.
And they got slammed. And I think there was a, one of them was chased by a lion, a real lion or something.
There were
stories. And there was a winger called Billy Steele, who I don't think ever recovered. He was a physical education teacher in the RAF in Scotland, who played in the first two tests. And I think that week destroyed him. But the Lions had just needed to celebrate. And, of course, they had Willie John and people who could always keep it within reason.
Yeah.
And nowadays, of course, there will be. I mean, they used to have a thing on Ireland. And I didn't drink in those days, or very, very little in those days. But they used to have a thing called Sunday School, where on the Sunday after the big game, after the Saturday team had played, they would relax in the morning and basically get plastered, sometimes sitting in a swimming pool, you know, and do it. And then they'd have the day to sleep it off. It was a day without training, etc. Where it becomes dangerous is when that situation that I described earlier, where the team is split.
Yeah.
Where you've got the B team, who are not going to make the tests. They know that the midweek games are not that important. And maybe then they'll go overboard. One of the Lions tours, I think they had the B team. I think they called themselves Donald's Donuts after Donald Lenehan, because they said, "Look, we're not going to make the test side." And in those days, it's slightly different now because you're always in with a chance in such a short series. But in those days, it was clear who the A team were, more or less who the A team were, and it was vital to have your captain of the B team. Of the dirt trackers. And we had Derek Cornell, who played in the first, and Derek Cornell understood the importance of supporting the first team, whether in training, whether, you know, being the tackle bags, doing whatever. And he also said, "Guys, the best way we can support is by winning every single midweek game."
Right.
And he said, "That's our goal." And it was that serious, still having fun, but serious, that brought the team together. And it's crucial, and it's not something you can detail. You can't write down a list of it. It's about individuals who are all superstars with their countries, and suddenly they find themselves. For example, in our day, I couldn't believe it. I described how getting on the Lions tour, I would have carried the bags, I would have cleaned the boots, I would have done anything, I would have played it prop forward if they'd asked me to do that. Some of the Welsh guys, and in those days, the Welsh considered themselves slightly superior. If it was clear they weren't in the test side, you could sort of pick up that it wasn't quite. Maybe a couple of them went home when they weren't actually that injured. They'd got their Lions qualification and they went. And that's all to do with that captaincy, that spirit, that chias, as they would call it, or hoil, the Welsh would call it, that you bring it together. And I mean, another classic example, the 1968 Lions had a bunch of hooligans. They had the kippers, and they had the drinkers, because half the team just wanted to go to bed at night, half the team wanted to get up to mischief, and they used to do all sorts of stuff. Since then, they have had, and Roger Young in Cape Town, great friend of mine, dentist in Cape Town, who was on that tour, I think they've had something like 15 reunions.
Wow.
15 reunions, mostly in Cape Town. Lifelong friends, family friends, everything. You know, best men, father, godparents to their kids, all that sort of stuff. And they lost the series narrowly, but they were well beaten in the series. Lost some provincial games, but that spirit stays together. Yeah. And when I'm talking to guys, I say to them, you know, guys, make the most of it, because one minute you're a 26-year-old scrum half on the Lions, the next minute you're turning 70.
Yeah.
You know, so build those memories. Build those memories.
All right. I am so excited for this. As I've been, everything we've previewed this year so far, it's been a great sporting year, but the Lions tour is something special. As we said at the start, every 4 years. And I know it's going to Australia, where the Lions have had their most success there. I think out of 9 tours, they've won 7. And they are very much the favorites. It kicks off on Friday against Argentina. And then there's basically all-out rugby for a good month. Wow, these guys are going to be so screwed come rugby championship time. And then, so the first one there, Wallabies versus the Lions, July 19th at Brisbane. The Wallabies take it there because they love that stadium. Other than the Springboks, they kind of always win there. Then they've got the Wallabies versus Lions at Melbourne. Now, these MCG is a huge stadium. It's going to be one of the most incredible vibes there. And then August 2nd will be the final one. Also, massive stadium in Sydney. That is your entire British and Irish Lions tour for 2025. John, we're going to finish off with some polls because this is how we finish the show. Last week, we had a poll around your favorite Grand Slam tournament. No surprises there. Aussie Open, US Open.
After this beautiful weekend.
Are on the background, but people love Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Wimbledon's, it's the best.
I get it.
This week's poll, though, so we get into the British and Irish Lions tour again. What's the series going to play out as? Ooh. Are we looking for a 3-0 Lions, 2-1 Lions, 2-1 Wallabies, or 3-0 Wallabies? If you think there's another permutation outside of that, drop it in the comments at TRN on the bounce.
Maybe a penalty shootout. How's that?
Another penalty shootout.
Does that count as different?
Yeah. Personally, I really want the Aussies to win this first test. I was about to say that,
and they will be going. Because you win that first test in a series, go back in history, you usually win the series, or at least draw the series, and that would set it up incredibly. Like the last Lions tour.
Yeah, because I really think that if you look at the squad, you mentioned it perfectly. The Aussies have great players, but you need that structure. The Springboks have shown you need to be able to scrum for 80 minutes. Yeah. The British and Irish Lions squad have got all of that. If the Aussies can just grab that first win, though.
Some hope.
That's all we want is neutrals. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Fabulous, guys. Great to chat.
I know this is tip of the iceberg here. I had so much other prep we didn't even touch on here. Yeah. But again, we've got cricket to watch. There's things to do. You're a busy man. Where else can people find you nowadays? Because you haven't just retired and gone gently into the night here.
No, well, I sort of did, you know. 30 years on 702 was a long, long time, and it had just come to the end. And in broadcasting terms, it was the friendliest separation ever. Yep. I told them 2.5 years, I want to retire. You know, getting up at 2:15 every morning for 17 years wasn't healthy, and I wanted to do some other things. And so 2.5 years later, we agreed on a time. They were very, very generous. Can you believe they gave my wife and I a trip to India, which has always been on my bucket list. That was a sort of thank you present. And now I've got involved with the History Channel. I'm making some documentaries with the History Channel, which is fascinating. Having hated history in school, I now realize how fascinated it is. And I've also been taken on by Power 987, the radio station, as a consultant, which are lovely. They're a fantastic station. And they came to me and said, John, you know, you're having made every mistake in the book on radio, and maybe at the end having corrected those mistakes, maybe there's something you can offer. And I'm absolutely delighted. And I think it's a Power 987 is going to grow, and it's got a role to play. And I'm proud to be there. And public speaking and Quizmaster, anything that involves fun, like coming on your show, which has been terrific.
And this is how we stay young, right?
Absolutely.
Keep challenging ourselves. Keep fueling our passions. All right. Next week, we are going to have a mid-year wrap-up. This year has gone pretty crazy. We need to take a little pause. We're going to have like a half term, basically, for the year. We've got a special guest coming in there. We're discussing all the sports because we haven't done that in quite some time. We've had some fantastic guests, which I hope you've enjoyed. And that'll be next week. Sorry, I'm still thinking Lions tour. I'm still thinking betting stuff. Yeah.
Cheers, guys.
After that.